Now, real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
Thank you very much and welcome back. Now, it is that time of the night where I have a special guest. Tonight is unusual for me because I tend to know a lot, well, a little about most things, but mythology wouldn't be one of them, to be honest with you. And we always like to have someone interesting and somebody different that we haven't covered before. And we learn something different from each and every guest that we have every night. So joining me on the show tonight, I have a mythologist, Anthony Murphy. And Anthony set up a website called Mythical Ireland, which began 24 years ago. On Mythical Ireland, he promotes ancient Irish archaeology, mythology and folklore and astronomical alignments. He's also written 10 books, fiction and non-fiction, including Newgrange Monument to Immortality and Mythical Ireland, New Light on the Ancient Past. Some of these his discoveries include several ancient dugout boats in the River Boyne and Dronehenge. Yes, you heard me right, not Stonehenge. Dronehenge, which is a late Neolithic henge near Newgrange. I'm sure you all went to see Newgrange when you were kids in school. Anyway, Anthony joins me on the line. Anthony, hi, how are you?
Hello, Niall. Good evening to you.
Good. Now, Anthony, you know, you're going to have to work with me here, okay? Because I certainly wouldn't have a huge knowledge when it comes to Irish mythology. But firstly, explain to me the difference between, you know, mythology and folklore. Because, you know, I could start talking to you about Darby O'Gill and the little people. But, I mean, what is the main difference between folklore? Or are the two really intertwined?
They're very similar, and I'm not sure that there's a hard and fast rule about how we should differentiate them. But the way I would differentiate them is this. Mythology is mostly that which was written down at some point in the past. And actually, most Irish mythology was written down in the Middle Ages. The oldest manuscripts containing Irish myths and legends date to around the 12th century onwards. That's AD. Folklore is that generally accepted as that which survives in oral form right down to the modern era. Mm. Folk tales about fairy forts and tales about Finn McCool and the sort of stuff that people continue.
The Children of Lear, actually. Do you remember the Children of Lear? That was one we did in school. Yeah. I always remember the Children of Lear.
Yeah, so that's how I would differentiate them. We're very lucky in Ireland in that the ecclesiastical scribes of the monasteries were the ones who wrote down the myths in the Middle Ages, because Ireland until the 20th century was really, you know, literally last century. Before that, most Irish people were they didn't read or write. I mean, we were in an oral culture, not just for hundreds of years, but in fact for thousands of years. So most of what we would call mythology survived in oral form until it was written down in the Middle Ages. And then folklore, some of it pertaining to perhaps older stories, survived right into the 20th and 21st centuries. But we're blessed in that there's a huge amount of it, you know. Many of your listeners will be familiar with classical mythology and the Greek and Roman mythology, which we, by the way, were taught by the Christian Brothers in school. But they never told us that Ireland had a very rich and wide corpus of mythological material, which is something I only learned after I left school, you know, and especially since I set up Mythical Ireland 24 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So how far back do we actually go? I mean, that we actually know for a fact that this happened. I mean, I'm sure from, you know, digging stuff up and stuff that we found within the ground, etc., you know, archaeological digs, etc. How far back can we trace it? Because somebody mentioned to me once about, say, for example, Newgrange. And most of us all went to see Newgrange as kids in school, right? That Newgrange is older than the pyramids.
Yeah, Newgrange, the accepted date for the building of Newgrange is 5,200 years ago, or 3,200 BC.
Wow.
And, you know, it's great that you raise that as an example, because Newgrange is, for me and my work, Newgrange is the star example, right? So the scholars of medieval manuscripts would generally argue that the mythology that was written down was sort of copies of stories that the monks had encountered on their travels in Europe. And of course, there's a lot of stuff that's been interfered with, as in church biblical Christian themes are woven into the stories. But now one of them in particular, pertaining to Newgrange, describes or appears to describe the sun god Dagda entering Newgrange because he's mating with Boin, the goddess of the Boin and that complex, Bruna Boinia, you know, the mansion of Boin. And it describes how they made the sun stand still in the sky while this was happening. Now, this was written down in the Middle Ages, as I said, by the monks. But in the Middle Ages, and up until the 1960s, in fact, Newgrange, the chamber was inaccessible. It had been blocked off since the late Neolithic or the early Bronze Age. We're told by archaeologists that this, the interior of Newgrange was inaccessible for 4,000 years. But here we have a myth written down in the Middle Ages that I would argue survives from prehistory, that appears to describe in sort of it's couched in mythological symbolism and language, where the sun god is entering the monument to mate with Boin, and they're making the sun stand still in the sky. Now, the solstice is the point at which the sun's daily rising position stops. The solstice is summer and winter are the only two stopping points of the sun in the year. So I would argue that that is a clear indication of knowledge in the Middle Ages of the solar alignment of Newgrange that hadn't been witnessed for 3,000 or 4,000 years. Now, just to go back to your original question, folklore. What about folklore? Never mind the stuff that was written down. When Professor Michael J. O'Kelly began his excavations at Newgrange in 1962, and he says it in his book about Newgrange, he's long dead now, he died in 1982, but in 1962, at the beginning of his excavations, lots of people told him, do you know, the sun shines into that monument, into the chamber, and lights up the triple spiral in there. Now, nobody was able to see that until he had carried out a repair or a restoration of the famous roof box above Newgrange, and in fact, he became the first human being to witness the sun in the chamber of Newgrange in 1967, 5 years after the beginning of the excavations, and we believe that he is the first human to see that in modern times, and in fact, the first human to see it since prehistory.
So in other words, that was passed down from person to person to person through
that
time.
That is what I would suggest. That's what I understand. I mean, is there another explanation for that? How would people know that information if they couldn't have witnessed it in their lifetime? And the people who told them that story, their fathers and grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers and all the rest, they couldn't have witnessed it
at
either.
At least 50 generations of people, probably,
Well, that's what I suggest. Now, that's an opinion wouldn't be mainstream.
Yeah, it sounds like something out of Indiana Jones, doesn't it? The light shines through at a certain time of the day. You know, and it just shows you, by the way, how clever people were. I mean, we talk about, of course, the pyramids and how they managed to get them up there so many years ago. The same would go for Newgrange and Stonehenge. And you discovered, by the way, Dronehenge. Now, firstly, what is a henge? And how do you describe a henge?
The simple explanation or description of a henge, Niall, is an enclosed space, enclosed by usually a circular embankment, inside which there's a ditch. So the basic henge is a bank, a circular bank, but the ditch is inside. Now, if you build a ring fort, which is a defended structure, the ditch is on the outside and the bank on the inside. So the henges would be more for some sort of ceremony or ritual. Mm. Now, they get more complex than that. Some of them have one opening, one entrance. Some of them have multiple entrances. Dronehenge is interesting because it appears to be a copy of one of those embanked henges. And, of course, we since 2018, when Dronehenge was discovered, we now have the boast. This is a major boast. Bruna Boinia has the highest concentration of henge monuments anywhere on the face of the planet.
Okay, so this is the River Boyne you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay.
The Bend of the Boyne, that complex of monuments, okay. Newgrange, Nowth and Douth, and the associated monuments. Now, Stonehenge is the famous henge, but and that's where the word henge comes from, because antiquarians of, say, the 17th and 18th century believed that the lintel stones at Stonehenge were actually used for hanging people. And they came up with this word hang, H-A-N-G-E, which was corrupted or bastardized to henge, H-E-N-G-E. So the word henge actually has no real bearing, but here's something for you now. In the past couple of years, I've been looking at the mythology of Bruna Boinia. One of the deities of Newgrange, Elkmar, is described in a story called Tuckmark Etain, The Wooing of Etain, standing on Newgrange, looking down at the boys crowds of them, the boys playing in the playing fields. Wow. And in the Irish version, the word is, or the compound word is, cluiche mai, which literally means cluiche for a game, cluiche pella, you know, yeah. And mai, M-A-G-H, which we know from place names as a plain or a flat area or a field. So basically, in mythology, we have a suggestion that if you're up at Newgrange, you would be looking down upon these arenas, as it were, these stadiums, which I believe is the Irish word for a henge, cluichimai, the games fields or the sports fields,
okay,
whatever they might have been used for.
Almost like the Colosseums in Athens or something like that, yeah.
Exactly. And the thing is, while some of them are embanked enclosures, in other words, they don't disappear from view. Some of them are still standing. They were built in the late Neolithic, we reckon, around 4,500 to 5,000 years ago. So they're a little bit younger than Newgrange, but not much. But some of them completely disappeared because they were originally built of timber. So when the timber rots away after 20 or 30 years and the thing falls out of use, basically it disappears and leaves a flat field and there's nothing to be seen until 2018, when the severe drought revealed crop marks of subsurface remnants of this structure.
Right.
But it's 500 feet in, it's 150 metres or 500 feet in diameter. A huge structure, clearly, I would say, clearly designed for some sort of mass spectacle in which something is happening in the interior, watched by perhaps a big crowd of people.
Feeding people, you know, to the lions.
maybe. Who knows? You know?
By the way, somebody texts in and says, ask him, has he seen Acklehenge? Have you seen Acklehenge?
I've never been to it. I've seen lots of pictures of it. And as you probably know, it's a very controversial structure.
Oh, is it? What's controversial about it? Give me the controversy. I love a bit of controversy.
Well, I don't know.
Holding back, Anthony, there. Look at you holding back.
I don't want to say too much, but what I will say is I don't like the look of it. It's far too modern and concretey looking. I mean, the funny thing is Stonehenge has become the universally known henge monument, and yet all the archaeologists who've studied it will tell you it's what we call an atypical henge. It's not typical. It's got the earthen bank, it's got the blue stones, it's got the sarsens, we now know just from the past week that one of the stones there was dragged all the way to Stonehenge from northern Scotland, which is incredible when you think about it, you know. Mm. But we don't have the stone element, or at least we don't think we had. By the way, at the bend of the Boyne, in a small area, I mean, it's maybe, you know, 3-4 kilometres wide by 2 kilometres north to south. In that small area, we have 130 odd prehistoric monuments. We've the largest passage tombs in Ireland, and we have up to a dozen henges, which is a massive amount crowded into a small space. So
absolutely.
We're talking about structures that would have required a huge workforce to build. I mean, I'm not talking hundreds. I'm not even talking thousands. I'm perhaps talking tens of thousands of people.
Okay, some of the texts that are coming in. Somebody says, oh my God, I love Anthony Murphy. I've met him in my travels. Ask him about Martin, who lived in Mexico when he died in the past year. He wrote a book too. And she sends in a picture of herself and Martin there, Derrianne.
Martin Brennan was an Irish-American. He was born in Bronx in New York, but his parents had emigrated to New York from Roscommon. He studied art at the Pratt Institute, and he was told when in Japan by an Aikido master, he was told, you need to go to the land of your ancestors. And he came to Ireland, studied megalithic art, and discovered a whole rake of things, fascinating insights. He discovered that one of the chambers at Douth was aligned on winter solstice sunset, which you know, proved that Newgrange was not alone in being astronomically aligned, and also the Cairn T sunrise alignment at Loch Crew. Sadly, Martin passed away last November 2023, having spent the last, I think, about 20 years of his life living in the jungle in Mexico. Extraordinary man, never owned a cell phone or a telephone or a computer or a typewriter. He wrote all his books in longhand, in cursive script. An incredible guy with a fascinating story. I mean,
I have a picture of him here in front of the listener sent in, Derianne. She's a listener to the show. She sent in a picture of herself and Martin at one of your meetings. So that's how obviously I know. Now,
I know Derianne, and hello to her, and I'm glad to hear that she's listening.
Well, look, you know, Ireland is steeped in history. Why are we so steeped in history? I mean, we're obviously a very old country. And for your mind, when you're, you know, when you're writing and studying and everything else, I mean, what is the most exciting part of this country when it comes to mythology for you? What is the most exciting part of it?
It's the multiple layers of it, Niall. It's the richness of it. It's the extraordinary breadth of it. There's just so much. For instance, you could decide to specialise in place name study, and you would spend a lifetime studying Irish place names, Irish townland names, Irish village names, old Irish place names that have disappeared into the mists of time. You could devote a lifetime dealing with the kings, the high kings of Tara, and the provincial and local kings. There's so many aspects, and I believe the reason it's so rich is, you see, at the end of the Ice Age, there was nobody living here. The first people came in as sort of migrants to Ireland about 9,000 years ago. We have had multiple waves of arrivals of people at various times, but this was all recorded in mythology, in the Book of Invasions, where it was said that, you know, the Partholonians and the Numidians and the Fervulug and the Tuatha De Danann and the Milesians came in. So it's almost like one of the fascinating things about Ireland and its rich mythological heritage is that the mythology and the history, which in many cultures seem so divergent, actually seem to, it's like the myth foreshadows actual events, you know. And the fact that I left school without knowing any of this. When I left school, I knew the story of the Salmon of Knowledge, the story of Setanta killing the hound, and the story of the aforementioned Children of Lear. I did not know that Ireland's mythology is comparable to classical mythology. There's at least as much, and there's at least as many heroes and warriors and villains and gods and anti-gods.
What about creatures? Do we have like, you know, Scotland have Loch Ness. Do we have any mythological creatures in this country?
We do. Okay. We do. We've one associated with the Boyne. And the Cara, don't forget, the Cara was the monster that St. Patrick was said to have defeated on Croagh Patrick and thrown into Loch Cara. But we also had a monster in the Boyne called the Mata, which was a giant centipede-like monster that basically lived in the Boyne River and drank up all the water until there was no water left. And it was cut into pieces at Newgrange and thrown into the river to sort of make the water flow again. And pieces of that monster became parts of the landscape. It's a very ancient creation myth. But listen to this. If you've got any listeners from Dublin, here's a boast for the Boyne Valley. Dublin's Irish name, Aclia, comes from that monster myth from the Boyne Valley. The rib cage of the monster floated down the Boyne, out through the estuary, down along the coast, down the Irish Sea, and into the River Liffey, where it's said to have formed the ford of Aclia, the ford of the hurdles, or the ford of the rib cage.
Wow.
So Dublin's Irish name comes from this origin myth from the Boyne Valley.
It's terrible to think about us Dubs came from Drogheda. I mean, I'm just that sent the chills through my spine, to be honest with you. I mean, in relation to characters, to, you know, mythology, you mentioned St. Patrick a few minutes ago. Of course, he's probably the most famous character that we have. I mean, these people were real people. Many of them were real people, weren't they? Or were they all? Were many of them just mythological people who didn't really exist?
My belief is that there would be a mixture. So some are purely deities, but some are probably, they were probably originally people whose exploits were imagined long after they died to have been so great and wonderful that they were deified, you know? Yeah. So we have the likes of, for instance, at Brúna Bonnia at Newgrange, we have Angus Og, Angus the young son of the Dagda, who basically took over Newgrange from his father and booted him out of the place.
He was the god of passion and love or something like that, wasn't he?
Because he was in love with Caer, the otherworld maiden who transformed into a swan, and he had to transform into a swan in order to be her lover. But here's the thing. In 2020, a paper was published in which they had, you know, analysed the genome, the DNA from a skull bone found in the chamber of Newgrange during the 1960s excavation. And that found that this man, who was about 35 or 40 when he died, was the product of a first degree incestuous relationship. In plain English, his mother and father were brother and sister.
Oh, and right. That
is typical of sanctioned dynastic.
That would have been quite common in those. That would have been quite common in those days.
Not common in ancient Ireland. Common in ancient cultures like Egypt, right? But not common in Ireland, where the geneticists tell us that the Neolithic population of Ireland was an outbreeding population. So this was highly unusual. This is a one-off event. And they've now speculated that he was probably a god king. In other words, that this was a man whose exploits were blown up into huge proportions to make it out that he was actually a deity. They may have actually convinced the population of the time that this man was literally the son of gods, you know.
There were many gods. I'm assuming like every other country, we had all our own gods, you know. I mean, and I'm looking at a list of gods here, for example. You know, you had Badab, the war goddess. You had Maka, the goddess associated with war and battle. The Morrigan, who's the goddess of battle. And we see, what's this? The Tree Dana, the three gods of crafting. I mean, I'm looking at it. We seem to have a god for everything. The god of the sea, of course, was Lear. Everybody knows Lear. So, I mean, we had a lot of gods, didn't we?
A whole pantheon. So before St. Patrick and Christianity in the 5th century AD and all of that, the Irish anciently seem to have believed in a pantheon of deities. It's a little bit, I say, like Hinduism. And I wonder whether people didn't, you know, like in Hinduism, find themselves adoring or worshipping one deity over the others. So we have, you know, we have Smith gods. We have gods who are responsible, like Mananon MacLear, the sea god. We have Dagda, who's clearly a sun god. You know, we have then the evil version of that, the Fomorian Balor, who seems to be a destructive aspect of the sun. So, yeah, we seem to have had this sort of whole array of gods and goddesses. By the way, long before the Christian Saint Bridget, one of the three great patron saints of Ireland, we had the goddess Bridget, who was a daughter of the Dagda. So there's
and she was associated with healing. See, I'm learning something here.
Healing and
fertility, and yeah.
Yes.
So what happened? So then, when Christianity came along 2,000 years ago, did we just abandon all these gods in favour of Christianity?
Didn't abandon them. It's amazing. What happened was that belief in the deities went underground. Publicly, you could only profess belief in one God and his son, who was your savior. But privately, a lot of people continued to believe in the deities, which later became the fairies, the good folk, the dinama, you know, the diminished version of the gods. They became diminished. They went into the she mounds when the Milesians, the mortal sons of the King of Spain, came in the Bronze Age, according to mythology. And they went into their she mounds. But the thing is, you see, they never died. They couldn't be killed. They're ever living. They're the ever living ones. And the folklore of recent centuries has been that the Dedannans would not just be resuscitated, as it were, but that they will come thronging out of the she mounds in the end of days to bring to fight this great last battle for the victory of Ireland. And of course, the prophecy is that they will be victorious. So they never actually went completely away. It's just that the worship of them had to be private, because if the parish priest or the bishop or the cardinal found out that you still professed faith in the old pagan deities, you'd be,
excommunicated
and humiliated and all.
Well,
the
okay,
rest,
just finally, know? Because unfortunately we're running out of time, I can have this conversation with you all night, by the way. It's so interesting. And there's so many questions, by the way, people are texting in as well. And you can get a lot of the answers to this question on your website. I'm going to talk about that in a second very briefly, but I've got literally 2 minutes here. But the mythological ghosts and what have you, the past, the banshee, the white lady, you know, the story, of course, of what happened, you know, when the devil was playing poker and sold his soul. All that kind of stuff. I mean, is that all just urban myths? I mean, does the banshee, you know, was there any stories from the banshee from previous times? Did that get passed down throughout the years as well and just exaggerated? This woman with the one eye and the comb in her hand?
I believe it's what we would call a folk survival, a folklore survival of something much more ancient. That would be my belief. Even her name, the woman of the she mounds are portals. They're not necessarily tombs in the mythological imagination. They're portals. They're doorways between this realm and another realm, the other realm in which the deities are existing. But we have the Kalyak. We have, you know, we have goddesses who are there as goddesses of death or psychopomps to guide you on your journey to the other world. I firmly believe that the Banshee is a late folk survival of something much more ancient.
Okay, so they're kind of, so there were goddesses of something different, probably goddesses of love, well, maybe not beauty, because we learned that she had long hair, one eye and a comb in her hand for some reason. I have no idea what that's all about. Listen, it's been just incredible talking to you because I'm really interested in Ireland.
Now, real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio.